more than 90 days since you joined AA. Still, you're sober. Isn't that what counts? You're sober and you haven't come close to slipping up. AA was built on a spiritual cornerstone, the concept of opening one's mind to embrace a power greater than oneself. You've done that. You understand why you were doing what you did for all those years. Maybe she wasn't even an alcoholic, an addict, in the first place. She just wanted to make it stop, all the drama in her head. She wasn't equipped to deal with it. Is she now? Time will tell. I don't know, Kathy, she hedges. I've got a lot going on before I get out of here, and anyway, I'll be coming back and forth once a week to bring my daughter for her visits with my husband, so maybe we can get together then.
We should still really touch base before you go.
Yes, they really should. Okay, I can do lunch if it's a quick one, she says reluctantly. Kathy names an Asian bistro not far from the library, and Cam agrees to meet her there at 12:30, after she drops off Tess at a pool party. Maybe after lunch she can stop at the library and pick up some books to take on the trip. Reading, once, along with writing, one of her favorite pastimes, fell by the wayside over the years, since it's difficult to focus on a meaty novel when you're comfortably numb. God knows she could use a non-toxic distraction these days, so she's been working her way through all the neglected titles on her own bookshelf and is thirsty for more. Not as thirsty as she once was for other things. One day at a time. That's all it takes. You can do it. You have no choice. She rests a hand against her belly, wishing the baby would kick or something. God knows she can use every possible nudge in the right direction. The dude's name, it turns out, was Edward Casalino Jr. His 22 years on Earth merited just 5 lines, 6 if you count the headline, Local Man Slain on Pacific Avenue. The short paragraph is buried inside the afternoon edition of the newspaper. Edward died of a single gunshot to the head. Execution style. No witnesses, no suspects. Police are investigating a possible connection to organized crime. Organized crime? Why? Because a guy's last name ends in a vowel? Whatever. They'll never figure out that Edward Casalino Jr.'s only crime was opening his big fat mouth. Here's your package, all the way from Texas, he'd commented, setting it heavily on the counter. Thing weighs a ton. He pointed at the return address. Lone Star Cattle Brands, huh? Gonna brand a herd of cows here in Atlantic City or what? He laughed at his stupid non-joke, oblivious to a tight-lipped reaction from his customer, indicating his fate had just been sealed. The newspaper lands in a garbage can. No need to read anything else in it. Why'd you have to say that, Edward? Why'd you have to look at the return address at all? Hundreds of packages come and go, and you have to comment on mine? It's a shame, because really, Edward might well have forgotten all about the package 2 seconds after handing it over, collecting the fee, and going back to sorting letters into rented mailboxes. Still, you can't be too careful. The phone rings again as Cam finishes loading the dinner plates into the dishwasher, and she decides to let Tess pick it up this time. Once again, though, it continues to ring, and Cam is forced to go over to see who it is. Recognizing her father's cell phone number in the caller ID window, she snatches up the receiver.
Pop!
Cam? He sounds surprised.
Yeah, hi, Pop.
Silence.
You called me.
I know. Of course I know I called you.
No, he doesn't. Either he dialed her by accident, or he dialed her, then forgot, in the seconds it took for the phone to ring and her to answer, who it was that he had called. It wouldn't be the first time. Sounding vaguely confused, Ike asks,
Well, how are you?
I'm good, Pop. How are you?
She asks, though she knows the answer. Wasted. The question is whether Ike Neary is just mildly trashed tonight, or on something other than beer. She'll know the answer if he starts telling her he's seeing spacemen, or angels, or Mom.
I'm good, he says. What about my girl? How's Tess?
He slurs the S's.
She's great. Can I talk to her?
Sorry, Pop, she's not here, Cam tells him, and wonders when she's going to stop trying to protect her daughter from her father's various weaknesses. Tess isn't stupid, and it's obvious Ike Neary, with his black t-shirts, gray ponytail, and tattoos, isn't exactly a traditional grandfather. Then again, Tess has never seen him distraught and delusional. Cam has, enough times to know she never wants to put her daughter through that.
Where is she? Pop is asking.
I'm not sure. Out with friends.
You're not sure? Ike echoes. What do you mean you're not sure? You can't just let her go running around in the night.
Cam's stomach turns over. It's okay, Pop, she says soothingly. But it isn't. In their world, her father's and hers, things happen to people. They die. They disappear. In our world? In the world. The big bad world, where hundreds, thousands of children never come home, and Cam gets to witness the excruciating details, sometimes all of them, from that first moment of terror to the dying breath. Yeah, things happen. And then you spend years trying to get over all of it in your own way, trying to numb yourself in your own way.
Pop, I want to see you, Cam says quietly. We're going down to Beach Haven in a few days. We'll be there most of the summer. Why don't you come stay for a while?
Maybe.
Say yes.
Yes, he says and laughs.
Really?
I don't know. I'll try, honey. Maybe he's not as wasted as she thought.
Pop, you have my cell phone number, right? Because there's no phone at the beach house.
I thought there was.
There is a line, but I don't bother to hook it up anymore. Tess and I both have cells and...
And Mike, too, right?
She hesitates. He doesn't know.
Right.
Okay, I'll call you.
My cell, don't forget.
I won't forget. Give Tess a big hug from me. Mike, too.
She swallows hard. She should tell him.
Pop.
I've gotta go, Cam. I'll talk to you soon. I love ya. Bye.
And just like that, he's gone. With a sigh, Cam hangs up the phone. For a minute or two, she just stands there, missing her father, missing Mike, missing the mother she barely knew, missing the sister she lost. Jesus, my whole life feels like a tragedy right about now. She shakes her head, needing to snap herself out of it. It isn't all tragic. She has Tess, and soon she'll have the baby, too. She's about to turn off the kitchen light when she remembers that she hasn't had her nightly glass of milk. Oh, ick. She defiantly reaches for the freezer instead of the fridge. Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia contains calcium. Right?
Right, but you know it's not as healthy.
She takes out the ice cream anyway and closes the freezer door hard. The new magnetic shopping list pad drops off the front. It does that frequently. The pad is too heavy for the size of the magnet, but she doesn't dare move the pad around to the side of the fridge. She doesn't want Tess to think she doesn't like it. Wearily, she bends to retrieve it and sticks it back on the door, glancing at the grocery list jotted on the top page. She's been adding items for the past few days as they occur to her. Supplies for the cottage, sunscreen and aloe, bug spray, the usual vacation stuff. True, she can buy it all on the island, but there's something tremendously gratifying about pulling up to the cottage with everything they'll need for the first couple of days. With a pang, she realizes that this year, she won't be buying the Pringles potato chips Mike loves to munch on at the beach. Neither she nor Tess likes them, or Dr. Pepper, his favorite soda, or a new kite for him and Tess to fly in the sea breeze.
Well, maybe I can start a new mother-daughter tradition instead, like spa massages, or Saturday night sushi, or something. Something she and Tess can do together. Just the girls, and not be so acutely aware of Mike's absence. After all, in summers past, he would sometimes leave the two of them at the shore for a few days while he returned to the city for work or went away on business. But that was different. This time he won't be around to do the driving down the Garden State Parkway or open and air out the house. Last year, there was a bat lurking inside. It swooped out of the closet when Cam was unpacking. She and Tess screamed and cowered in the bathroom while Mike chased it out with a tennis racket. Who will chase bats this year? Who will fly the kites and grill the steaks and set up the beach umbrella so that it doesn't get picked up by the wind and go cartwheeling down the sand? I will, Cam tells herself resolutely. I'll just have to learn how to do everything by myself, since that's how it's going to be from now on. Ike looks down at the cell phone in his hand. Who was he going to call? Or did he just call someone? He's not quite sure. You're losing it, Ike, baby. That's Brenda's voice in his head. Or is she here? He looks around. No sign of Brenda. No sign of anything, or anyone familiar for that matter. With a sigh, Ike shoves the phone into the back pocket of his jeans, no longer interested in who he might have called or been about to call. What's more important, for the time being, is figuring out where he is and how he got here. Carrying the carton of ice cream and a spoon, Cam goes into the adjacent sunken sunroom. This is her favorite place in the house, with its high ceiling, slate floor, and brick walls lined with tall arched windows and French doors. When they first moved in, Cam filled the space with plants, comfortable chintz-covered furniture, books, lamps, throw rugs. She and Mike used to sit here cozily after dinner, catching up on each other's days while Tess played with the toys that used to fill the antique wooden chest in the corner. She would take things out one at a time. After playing with a toy, she'd return it to the chest before getting a new one. Model child. Now the toys are long gone, and the chest is filled with old blankets. Standing in the dark, Cam looks out over the deep, landscaped lot, lit by strategically placed timer floodlights among the trees. Where she once envisioned the built-in swimming pool she and Mike had always wanted, there's only grass, shrubs, trees. In the far corner, alongside the small shed, is an elaborate, weathered wooden playset. It has swings, a slide, monkey bars, a climbing wall, a rope swing, a little two-story house. Everything but a hot tub, as Mike used to say. Last summer, he was talking about having it dismantled and replacing it with a much bigger shed, but Tess wouldn't hear of it. So you plan on swinging and sliding your way through high school? He teased her.
Dad, no. I just don't want you to get rid of it yet.
Why not?
Because I used to love it, and I don't know. It would be sad.
So they kept the playset. And Mike got rid of Cam, whom he himself used to love, instead. Okay, maybe that's not fair. She turns away from the window and flicks on a lamp. Then again, maybe it is. Cam sits heavily on the couch and swings her legs onto the glass coffee table. After removing the round cardboard carton top from the ice cream, she moodily jabs in her spoon and swallows a heaping mouthful.
Ow! Head freeze.
She winces and wedges the spoon into the carton and sets it on the table. Off balance, thanks to the vertical spoon, it promptly tips over. Ignoring it, her head spinning painfully, she massages her temples with her fingertips. But it isn't just a head freeze. It's another vision. Oh, no. Ice cream. That's the first thing she sees. Not cherry, though. It's chocolate, studded with fudgy chunks in an oversized waffle cone instead of a carton. Cam is nauseated. Because of the chocolate? Because she's afraid of what else she's going to see? A girl. A girl is holding the ice cream, and it's melting faster than she can lick it. The sun is blazing overhead, and Cam would know it was hot and humid, even if it wasn't for the dripping ice cream,
because the girl's face is flushed and shiny, and her bangs are damp. She's about Tess's age, cute, petite, a carrot top with a pair of braids that hang just past her chin. Her freckled cheeks are sunburnt. She's wearing a green cotton top that has spaghetti straps tied in little bows over her shoulders, also freckled and sunburnt. Her feet are in white sandals, her toenails polished hot pink, and, oh God, oh God. Around her neck is a silver chain with some kind of small triangular black pendant hanging from it. Cam saw a similar pendant in her last vision, the one she had of the small blonde in the plaid school uniform. What does it mean? Okay, don't get distracted by it. Focus. What else do you see here? Behind the girl is a brick wall that's been painted bright blue. On it, off to the far left and painted in red bubble lettering, are the letters L and F. The girl is laughing, looking at someone Cam can't see. Then all of a sudden, her face twists into a grotesque mask of terror, and she lets out a blood-curdling scream. The vision fades before Cam can get anything else from it. Something's going to happen to that girl. Does it have something to do with the unusual necklace she's wearing? One thing is certain. Wherever she is, or will be, Cam has been there before. The bright blue backdrop is strikingly familiar. What else? Let's see. The red letters. On autopilot, she reaches into an end table drawer, rooting around for something to write with, and on. Nothing, just the television remote, an old pair of Mike's reading glasses, a tangle of cables from some forgotten electronic device. Keep going over everything, she tells herself as she hurries toward the kitchen, the ice cream forgotten in the sunroom. Remember the details. The girl, about 13 but tiny, a freckled redhead with short braids, sunburn, green top, hot, sunny, melting chocolate ice cream, blue painted brick, red letters, L, F. Those letters mean nothing to Cam. L, F. L, F. What could that be? Left field? Part of a word? Can LF be the girl's initials? In the kitchen, Cam grabs the magnetic grocery list pad stuck to the front of the fridge. She finds a pen, flipping over the shopping list, and begins scribbling on the back. She painstakingly writes down all the details of her vision, just as she used to do in the old days, back when she thought she could do something about them. Now that they've returned? Who knows? She's a grown woman now, a mother, able to relate with that visceral, there but for the grace of God, horror only a parent can truly understand. Maybe that will make a difference in what she can perceive and what she can do about it. Or maybe not. But it could be worse, she reminds herself with a shudder. It could be my own child in danger. She pushes that horrific thought from her mind, along with her father's words. What if something happens to her? What if she disappears? Fighting paranoia, Cam flips back to the shopping list side and sticks the pad back on the fridge. Later, she'll copy the notes over onto a clean sheet of paper. For now, it's enough that she got it all down. Then she heads upstairs to check on Tess. She hasn't heard from her in a few hours. Not unusual. She didn't pick up the phone either, though, when it rang. And between what just happened and her conversation with her father, Cam's maternal nerves are on edge. She tells herself she just wants to make sure Tess is dutifully packing for the trip, when in reality, she just wants to make sure, what? That she's there, in her room, safe and sound? The door is closed. Cam knocks. No reply. Heart pounding, she knocks again, calls, Tess? Still nothing. She reaches for the knob. What if she opens the door and finds an empty room? That won't happen. Don't be ridiculous. Of course she's here. Please let her be here. Slowly, Cam turns the knob, unable to escape the icy grip of every mother's worst nightmare. At least it hasn't rained in a few days, though it's forecast for tomorrow. When it rains, there's mud, and mud is heavy. Dirt is heavy too, but not as bad. Heap after heap of it lands off to the side, near a pile of branches and leaves that were lying on top of everything for added camouflage. Mud or no mud, this is backbreaking work. Good thing I'm strong. I can handle it. All I need is a heating pad later, and a good night's sleep on a hard mattress. Tomorrow I'll be good as new. At last, the shovel makes a dull scraping sound as the metal tip encounters hard wood. That's it. See? I told you it wouldn't take long.
What is it?
The girl asks fearfully, not nearly as friendly as she was earlier at the bus stop. Your mother told you how many times never to talk to strangers, and what do? You go off with the first stranger who wins you over with the oldest trick in the book. A nice present, and a promise to make you a star. It really is shocking that she didn't know better. It would be maddening, too, if the entire plan didn't hinge on that very naive gullibility. She should have known better. She should have listened to her mother. Little girls should always listen to their mothers. Mothers know best. Then again, there's always a chance that she recognized you despite your disguise and didn't let on. A wig, dark glasses, some padding. Maybe she saw right through it. Maybe she knew it was you, and she was relieved that you found her at last, and she's just playing along with the charade. In which case, you can save yourself a lot of back-breaking trouble and come clean right now. But what if she doesn't really know? What if the minute she finds out, she tries to bolt?
What is it? She asks again. What's down there?
A buried treasure chest, remember? Like I told you. An old sea captain hid it here 200 years ago. Gold doubloons, jewels. What else would be in a treasure chest? Goblets and priceless heirlooms, more prehistoric shark's teeth, like the one I sent you. Is she still wearing it? Stop digging. Quick glance. Yes. Good. But a look at her face reveals that the kid doesn't know who she's dealing with, and she isn't buying any of this treasure crap anymore.
I want to go home.
Don't you want the grand prize?
No.
I thought you wanted to be on my show. Reality TV. Such a great ruse. Amazing how easy it is to convince any reasonably gullible modern kid, one who doesn't heed her mother's cautions anyway, that she's been selected as a contestant for a new reality TV game show. All it took in this case was a letter written on fake production company letterhead. The subject line was marked Top Secret, and details about the show followed. The accompanying package contained the necklace, of course, made from the shark's tooth. The girl was instructed to wear it on the designated day and meet the producer at the designated school bus stop at the designated time. All very official.
I don't want to be on your show anymore.
She's almost wailing now.
I just want to go home.
You will, with a treasure that will make your whole family rich. Just a little more dirt to push aside with the shovel now. Hopefully she won't decide to make a run for it. But then, these days, who doesn't want their 15 minutes of fame? She's still thinking there's a chance.
Why aren't you filming this part?
She asks, a little reproachfully. I had to dig up the treasure. Ah, there it is. The iron ring attached to the trap door. All it takes is a mighty tug to pull it open, and then...
What are you doing?
The girl screams, finding herself being yanked toward the gaping hole in the ground.
Stop it!
One shove, and she tumbles into the black depths with a terrified scream. Below, there's a dull thud, a moan. Good. The fall didn't kill her. Anything broken? No reply. Hello down there, any broken bones?
Please, why are you doing this?
Because I know who you are, and you know who I am now, right? Admit it. Game over.
What?
Don't play dumb. You thought you could hide from me, but you can't.
Please, I don't know what you're talking about. Please, I want my dad, and...
Look out below. A flashlight goes sailing down into the hole. Next, the purple nylon backpack, now missing the metal zipper pull with her name on it, the one she bought with her allowance at a cheap souvenir stand in Seaside Heights a few summers back. She was so thrilled when the spinner rack held one with her name on it, spelled the right way, no less. Heads up, here comes your breakfast. Down go a plastic bottle filled with water and a white paper bag containing a roll. Lunch and dinner, too, so make it last. And listen, it's not so bad. Your Christmas presents are waiting for you when this is all over. From below, hysterical sobbing as the trap door comes down with a satisfying thud. Time to start digging again. Shovelful by shovelful, the dirt is moved again to cover the door. On top of that, the pile of branches that look like a pile of brush left over from spring cleanup. There. All that remains is the barely audible sound of pitiful cries coming from far below, courtesy of the air vents. That's okay. There's no one around to hear it. And if she keeps it up, she'll eventually cry herself hoarse, just like the old days. Tess! Cam turns the knob, jerks the door to her daughter's bedroom open in a panic, certain she's going to find it empty, an open window, a ransom note. Mom, what are you doing? Tess is standing in front of her open closet with clothes on hangers draped over her arm. She angrily jerks tiny white earphones out of her ears and fumbles with the device clipped to the waistband of her jeans. Oh. I'm sorry. I thought... You had been abducted by some psychotic stranger. Go ahead, Cam. Say it. Say it and watch her do that eye roll thing.
I'm sorry, Cam says again, and decides to leave it at that.
She presses a hand against her racing heart, resisting the urge to rest the other one protectively against her womb. To her shock, Tess's expression softens.
It's just that you scared me, barging in like that.
I knocked.
Well, I couldn't hear you.
Obviously not. Cam can hear the music blasting from the minuscule speakers even from across the room.
What are you listening to? 50 Cent.
Yeah? She makes an effort not to show her disapproval.
Did you ever listen to that Springsteen song Grandpa wanted you to hear?
Yeah, it was good,
Tess says briefly. You didn't listen to it.
Yes, I did. I liked it.
Did Grandpa really play with Bruce at the Stone Pony when he was young?
Younger.
Even in his 70s, Pop wasn't exactly young. And yeah, he did. Pop has told Tess all about his Asbury Park days. He really was a legend back then, and not just in his own mind, as far as Cam recalls.
Are we going to see Grandpa when we go to the shore?
You mean see him play with his band, or just see him?
Both.
Cam hesitates.
I'm sure we will, she tells Tess.
He's always around somewhere down there. Tess smiles, probably thinking, yeah, that's my grandfather, the harmless, eccentric musician.
Mom?
Yeah? Her daughter hesitates.
I was wondering...
Yeah?
Dad really seems like he wants to come down for the 4th of July. He kept saying he didn't want to take me away from you because he felt bad for you staying all alone in the cottage.
He said that? Tess hedges for the briefest moment before saying,
Yep.
But he didn't say it. She can tell. Tess is trying to get them back together. Cam tries to think of a way to tell her daughter that it's futile. Instead, when she opens her mouth, she hears herself say, I'll ask him. Tess lights up.
You will?
Sure. But don't get your hopes up, Tess. And I won't, either. Home at last after a miserably long day at work, Mike settles in front of the television. It's a wall-mounted plasma one, just like in the living room back in Montclair. He bought it last week,
thinking it would make him more comfortable here. Somehow, it's had the opposite effect. The TV seems ridiculously oversized in this urban living room, the couch, leather, also like home, yet not, positioned much too close to the screen. He had no choice, though. The square footage of the entire apartment is smaller than the master suite he shared with Cam, which, ironically, seemed to be closing in on them during those last few weeks he lived there. It's not easy to share a room, a bed, with your wife, once you've decided she isn't going to remain your wife. At the time, he kept thinking it might have been easier, or it might not have to happen at all, if he could just take a step back to think things through. But there wasn't time or space or opportunity. Feeling hemmed in, he made a snap decision and fled. What's done is done. He's made a fresh start. He should stay focused on the future. The thing is, there isn't much to look forward to. Work, sleep, takeout, watching Yankees games on TV, maybe a few from the stands if he gets lucky again, possibly some golf if he can get out to a course on the weekend. Even the looming summer weather isn't exactly a plus when you're stuck in the city. He's got a 2-week business trip to Japan in July, but aside from the sushi, nothing great about that. There's Tess, always the bright spot in his world, but last evening ended on a sour note that left him wary of their upcoming visits, especially the 4th of July holiday, when he'll have to figure out a way to keep her entertained in the city or take her away somewhere, just the two of them. It's hard enough trying to make conversation with a 14-year-old for hours on end over dinner and weekend visits. How is he going to fill 4 days? Mom and Dad would help if I take her to their house for the weekends. They live in the Connecticut suburbs, Darien. They have a spacious guest suite, a picturesque patio right on the Sound, and a sailboat Tess loves. The only thing is that Mike's father can be counted upon to touch upon the subject of his soon-to-be ex-daughter-in-law. He won't exactly be singing her praises. Mike doesn't want to subject Tess to that. Hell, he doesn't like to listen to it himself, which is why he hasn't returned his mother's calls in a few days. He knows that if he gets on the phone with her, she'll put Dad on eventually. He's always around now that he's retired. Oh well. All Mike has to worry about right now is the Yankees post-game report so he can catch the highlights he missed. He's doing just that, feet propped on the coffee table and a cold can of Dr. Pepper in hand, when the phone rings. In the caller ID box is a New Jersey area code, his home number. Old home number, that is. Tess. Good. He mutes the television and answers the phone. Hi, sweetie. Silence. Then, it's me. Cam? Mike sits up straight, swings his feet around to the floor. Oh, I thought you were... Tess, I know. She laughs awkwardly. He quickly considers making a joke about what he might be calling her, Cam, these days, instead of sweetheart. No, bad idea. In fact, he can't think of a worse idea, much less a better one, so he lets her do all the talking. Listen, Mike, we're getting ready to leave for the shore, and I just wanted to talk to you about maybe coming down. You mean instead of your bringing Tess up for her weekly visits? He asks, immediately defensive. Because the separation agreement is supposed to be...
No, that's not what I meant at all.
Then what? A pause.
I'll bring her up to Montclair for her visits with you, don't worry.
Cam's tone is brittle.
I just thought... But you know what, it was a bad idea.
Wait, no, don't backpedal. Say what you were going to say. What was a bad idea? He asks. Earlier, Tess had the same disappointed, disillusioned tone, the same blurting, then halting conversational style. Is Cam filling her head with bitterness about him?
Your coming down to the cottage while we're there is a bad idea, Cam's saying, because I don't want Tess to get the wrong idea about us. She might think...
Yeah, she might.
Still, she was actually going to invite him down to the shore?
If she had, how could he have turned her down?
Come on, how could you not? You can't let Tess get the wrong idea that her parents are getting back together.
Unless we did actually end up getting back together. In which case, his going to the shore would be the right move and a great idea.
Listen, I should go, Cam says.
So should I. He wishes he had said it first. Hates that he's feeling so childish. Wishes she would say something more. Something other than...
Goodbye, Mike.
Chapter 5.
It really looks like rain. Are you sure Lily's still having the pool party? Cam asks Tess as she steers the Volvo down a leafy suburban street lined with mansions in various architectural styles. Greek Revival, Federal, Tudor, Contemporary. Whenever she ventures into this particular neighborhood, she realizes that her own two-story brick home, which once seemed so extravagant, isn't the least bit impressive by Montclair standards.
Lily's got an indoor pool, so it can rain all at once, Tess informs her.
Oh, right, I forgot.
Sheesh, an indoor pool. The Hastings don't even have an outdoor pool.
We should have put one in, Cam thinks wistfully, remembering all the times she and Mike had discussed it.
If they had, maybe Tess would be hosting a pool party right now, and there would be annuals in all the flower beds, and Mike would be there barbecuing, and she'd be picking out paint colors for the nursery, and we'd be one happy family, and none of this ever would have happened.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
Makes a hell of a lot of sense, doesn't it? You find yourself living a life you never expected, so you over-examine everything that led up to it. You retrace every turn you ever took or didn't take, every possible omen you blithely ignored, trying to figure out where the path veered off in the wrong direction. Part of the problem is that she was driving under the influence, as it were. If there really was a turning point on her marital journey, she was probably to...
Stop!
Cam reflexively slams on the brakes as Tess cries out, her right arm flying over to shield her daughter.
You just passed it, Mom.
What?
Lily's. You drove right past her house.
Oh, sorry. She takes a second to regroup, then shifts into reverse and backs up along the curb. Tess bounces a little in the passenger seat. She seems antsy about this party, or maybe just eager to get there. Back home, she kept prodding Cam, worried she was going to be late.
I'll pick you up at 3.
3:30, please?
3, if you want to have time to stop and get Daddy a Father's Day gift. That was Cam's idea. She'd decided to be the bigger person and actually take Tess shopping for something nice for Mike, same as she always has. Only this year, the gift won't be from both of them, and it can't have anything to do with grilling or lawn care or the house, since Mike now lives in a city apartment. That kind of narrows the field to golf or something to wear. Oddly, Tess suggested a necklace.
Daddy doesn't really wear jewelry, Cam had pointed out, and had to keep from saying other than a wedding ring.
She assumes he no longer wears his, but hasn't had the nerve to ask Tess. Maybe she doesn't really want to know.
Not a fancy necklace, Tess had said. Something more like, you know, like Granddad wears.
Pop, the aging beach bum rocker? Somehow, Cam finds it hard to picture Mike wearing puka shells or braided leather around his neck. But if Tess wants to get something like that, it's fine with her.
How about 3:15?
Tess persists.
No, geez, Tess, stop pushing, Cam snaps.
We have a lot of stuff to do today and... Oh, no.
What's wrong?
She sighs. I forgot my shopping list back home.
Why don't you go back for it?
She shakes her head wearily. I'll just have to try and remember what's on it.
Listen, 3 o'clock, okay?
This time, Tess doesn't protest. That's a good sign. Watching her daughter swing her orange beach bag over her shoulder and head through the pillared gates of Lily's house, Cam decides the time alone together at the beach will do them both a world of good. Plus, once she knows about the baby, Tess is bound to be excited. She always used to say she wanted a little sister or brother. Who knows? Maybe if Mike and I had... Oh, for Pete's sake, cut it out. You can't second-guess every move you ever made. It's over. Move on. Disgusted with herself, Cam drives toward the business district to meet Kathy for lunch. A few drops splat onto the sidewalk as Kathy walks the short half-block to the restaurant from her car. She looks up at the overcast sky. It's threatening to open up any second now, and she doesn't have a jacket or umbrella. Normally, she welcomes a good cleansing rain. It wouldn't be a problem today if she wasn't wearing this new pale yellow silk blouse. Yes, she bought it for next to nothing at a sale, but that doesn't mean she can afford to have it ruined with water splotches. Oh well, she'll just have to wait it out at the restaurant until the storm has passed. Maybe Camden won't be in such a rush to leave after all. She claimed she had a lot to do, but maybe she was just giving herself an out. Not that I blame her. I pretty much pushed her into having lunch with me today. But she's a big girl. She could have said no if she really wanted to, right? Maybe not. I can be very persuasive, Kathy thinks, smiling to herself. Cam is waiting in front of the hostess stand when Kathy arrives. She's wearing crisp white pants and a lacy beige top. Gold hoop earrings hang below her dark ponytail. She has on a light floral perfume and makeup, too. She's much more pulled together than she usually is for the AA meetings, where she tends to wear jeans and t-shirts, as if trying to fade into the background. Kathy knows the feeling. I'm so glad to see you. You look good, Kathy says, even as she privately decides Cam looks a little wan. Thanks. I wish I felt good, Cam replies, and her oops expression makes it obvious she didn't mean for that to slip out. Kathy remembers that she said something yesterday about going to the doctor. Are you sick?
No, just tired. Should we be seated?
It takes a few minutes for that to happen, despite a reservation. It's the height of lunch hour. Fairly new and instantly trendy, the narrow bistro has all the requisite elements: high ceilings dotted with dim recessed lighting, exposed brick, blonde wood, and attractive staff with an attitude. They study leather-bound menus while they wait.
Have you ever been here before?
Cam asks. Yes, it's good, Kathy lies. She glances around as the hostess leads them through the crowded dining room, hoping she won't see anyone she knows. This place is deliberately off her beaten path, but you never know. If she runs into anyone, she'll have to make introductions and explanations, and she isn't in the mood to play that game. One charade at a time, Kathy tells herself, and wishes she could order a vodka tonic. Of course, she asks for sparkling water when the kimono-clad waitress arrives, as does Cam. They both decide on the pad thai with prawns without consulting each other. Great minds think alike, Cam says with a smile. Glad Cam can't read hers, Kathy asks if she's looking forward to getting away tomorrow. I will be, once we're there. I love Long Beach Island. Have you ever been there? No, Kathy lies. Obviously you have, though. Every summer of my life, and we have a house there now. Kathy raises her eyebrows as if this is news to her. How nice. So it's familiar territory?
Yeah, although nothing feels like familiar territory lately, so...
I know the feeling. It's all uncharted when you're trying to get through every day without your crutch.
Right.
That's why you need to get yourself to meetings while you're gone, daily, if you can.
I'll try, but my daughter will be with me, so...
There are a million excuses. Don't fall into that trap. Cam looks like she wants to defend herself. Then she merely shrugs and flashes a tight smile.
I'll get to meetings.
And we can check in with each other every day. Should I call your cell phone, or is there a number there I can reach?
My cell is best.
Kathy pulls out her own phone and pretends to make sure she has Cam's cell programmed in, as if it hasn't been there for years.
Sitting in the hot tub up to her bare shoulders, Tess stares through a wall of glass at the sweeping view of the Manhattan skyline 12 miles away. Emily Pfister is in the midst of an endless description of the dress she's wearing to her godmother's wedding, and Tess wishes she could go dive into the pool and cool off. She's been in here for at least half an hour, and she's feeling like a boiled potato. Looks like one, too. She's so white. If only she'd thought to get a fake tan like pretty much every other girl here. They all go to this place where you get sprayed and contoured and wind up looking like you just got back from a week in Saint-Tropez or wherever it is that fancy people spend their beach vacations. Tess is positive it's not the Jersey Shore. She's feeling out of her element, again. And that surprises you? It shouldn't. You knew this would happen. It always does. Yeah, but she promised herself before she got to Lily's party that she wasn't going to let it bother her that a lot of the kids are richer than she is, and all of them seem way more sophisticated, even the few who aren't upperclassmen. Spotting Lily sitting on a chaise nearby, barefoot, wearing a sarong and a bikini top, her silky black hair hanging loose down her back, Tess climbs out of the hot tub at last. She quickly wraps herself in a beach towel, self-conscious about her pale, scrawny body. Then she shoves her feet into the new hot pink flip-flops Mom just bought her to match her new bathing suit. They're not the thin rubber drugstore kind with the hard plastic strap. These have polka-dot fabric strips tied into bows and a contoured sole. They had cost a lot for flip-flops, but she was able to talk Mom into them, plus a new pair of sunglasses. Her mother's trial separation guilt might ultimately help fill out Tess's wardrobe, even if she still has more rules than a kindergartner. "Hey, have you heard from Morrow?" Tess asks, going over to Lily. "How come she's not here yet?" "Oh, she's coming." Is it her imagination, or does Lily look uncomfortable? "Are you sure? Because I tried calling her like 3 times this morning and she didn't pick up." "You know how she is. She probably forgot to charge her cell. Did you check out the string bikini Brooke Billings has on? I would kill to look that good in that."
"Oh, please."
"You would look that good in it," Tess assures her friend. "I'm the one who'd look like someone's cross-dressing kid brother." Lily laughs but says, "Come on, you know you'd look great." "No, I don't." Tess shakes her head and glances down at the two-piece hot pink bathing suit she ordered because the catalog said it was supposed to enhance her figure. The twin fabric triangles that make up the top are padded, but she still can't fill it out. She won't blame Heath if he told Chad he's not interested in her, provided he even knows who she is. Why couldn't she have long legs and curves, like the other girls here, and everywhere else, for that matter? Even her own mother looks pretty good in a bathing suit. Then again, maybe not this summer. Mom seems to have crossed the fine line from curvy to chubby. Tess noticed in the car this morning that she's getting a bit of a gut, and her face is getting full. She felt like reminding her that she'll never get Dad back if she lets herself go. But she didn't. It seemed too mean. And anyway, she was kind of relieved to realize that Mom probably wouldn't be letting herself go if she was seeing someone else, like Morrow and Lily claimed. So, all things considered, the weight gain is a good sign. "So, are you having a good time?" Lily asks her, looking a little restless, like she'd rather go off and mingle. "Yeah, great party." And so different from the gathering she used to go to when she went to private school. Back then, everyone usually had slumber parties and just invited girls from their own class. Those parties were stressful in their own way. Someone usually brought cigarettes or wanted to sneak out or sneak boys in. Plus, Tess would try to stay awake all night because bad things happened to whoever fell asleep first. The other girls would put ridiculous props around the unfortunate victim and take pictures, or stick her hand in warm water so she'd pee her pants. Thank God those days are over. Then again, parties this year have been stressful in a different way. At the beginning of the year, she went to a few that were given by her old private school friends, But their social circle had branched out since Tess had left, and there were always so many new people around. Tess wanted to reminisce with her old friends in front of them, just to remind everyone that they had a history. But no one was really into looking back. Gradually, the invitations from her old crowd stopped coming, and she was secretly relieved. By then, she had Lily and Morrow and a whole new crowd that invited her to their parties, and she fit in, for the most part. For a while. She's been feeling insecure lately, though. Even more so watching Jordan Runyon, who is a sophomore and would be even more beautiful if she wasn't always wearing such a mean, pinched expression, emerge from the pool, looking like a glistening goddess. "How's the hot tub?" Lily asks Tess. "Hot." "That's kind of the point."
"Yeah, but after a while."
"Why don't you go in the pool then?" Lily sounds like a busy mother trying to find something for her bored toddler to do.
"No way, I'll get soaked."
"That's kind of the point," Lily says again, and this time she doesn't smile.
"I'll go in later."
Tess had spent a lot of time on her hair and makeup, which is waterproof, but still. This is her big day. Her last chance to make Heath fall in love with her, maybe. She doesn't want to look like a drowned rat when he shows up.
"Have you seen what's going on over there?"
she asks Lily, and gestures at the pool. A bunch of girls are floating around on air mattresses, and the guys keep swimming up beneath them and dumping them into the water. The girls shriek and pretend they're furious, then make a big show of shaking out their hair and settling their perfect bodies on their floats again. Pretty ridiculous.
"Yeah," Lily says. "It looks fun."
"Fun?" Tess sighs.
"I just wish Morrow and Chad would get here."
"What you mean is you wish Heath would get here. Admit it."
"Are you sure he's coming?"
"That's what he said, but I didn't actually talk to him. Yesterday, Morrow said Chad told her."
"And you're sure she didn't mention anything to you about what Heath said when Chad told him about me?"
"I'm positive." Lily looks bored. They've already had this conversation today. Twice. Tess tries to think of something else to say, but everything that pops into her head involves Heath. "I think I'm going to go see if anyone wants another margarita." Lily swings her feet over to the slate floor.
"Do you want one?"
"No, thanks." Lily's been spiking the blender drinks with tequila from her mother's liquor cabinet. Tess has no interest in ever becoming Tess Hastings Pickering with a fridge full of booze. No way. Her life will turn out much differently from her mother's, because she's not going to make the same stupid mistakes. Cam's car isn't in the driveway when Mike pulls up to the house in the rain. Either it's in the garage or she's out. He figured on a 50-50 chance of that, since Tess said something last night about having to go to a party this afternoon. He had even considered calling ahead, but decided not to. The last thing he needs is another awkward telephone conversation with Cam. Parking the Saab in the empty driveway before the three-car garage, he can't help but think of the rented stall where he's forced to keep it back in Lower Manhattan. A car can be a liability in the city. Too bad he can't just leave his here in Jersey. But that would force him to take the train back and forth whenever he comes to see Tess. No way. Not that he didn't take it daily as a commuter all those years he lived here. Still, there's something empowering about coming and going in a car, as opposed to public transportation and a cab from the station or, worse yet, asking Cam to pick him up and drop him off. Mike climbs out of the Saab, heedless of the downpour, struck by a memory of how she used to drive him to and from the train station years ago, when they first moved here. They had only one car then, and assumed that would work. Cam assured him she didn't mind shuttling him back and forth, often in her slippers and pajamas, with little Tess in back and a great CD on the car stereo. That lasted a year, tops. Then Mike got promoted and started working later and later, and Tess wasn't thrilled to spend so much time strapped in her car seat, and Cam had begun the slow retreat behind the wall. So they bought a second car
and he took over the round trip to the station. Good thing, because by the time he got home most nights, there was booze on his wife's breath. Then again, maybe she never would have had an evening drink in the first place if she thought she had to drive. Maybe it was the second car that did them in. Maybe everything would be fine between them if she was still driving him to the train in her pajamas, stone sober, and singing along to Southside Johnny. Christ, why do I do this to myself? Mike slams the car door and walks across the rain-slicked pavement to the garage, noticing that the empty garden beds have turned to mud puddles. Maybe he should call Ron, the landscaper, and have him come by to put in some flowers. Then again, what does he care? He's not the one who has to look at the barren beds every day. But he cares, because Tess has to look at them, and because he still owns the house, and it bugs him that Cam hasn't planted the flowers, damn it. Just because. He peers through the garage door window to see if the Volvo is there, hoping, not sure what he's hoping, that she's in, that she's out. It changes from one moment to the next. She's out. Okay, good. That's what he was hoping. At one point, anyway. He hesitates for only a moment before heading for the front door. After pressing the alarm code, he steps into the house and is struck by the familiar scent. No one specific aroma, just a blend that combines into the unique smell of home. It hits him hard and gives him pause. His own place smells like a recent paint job and his neighbor's cats. Here, there's something savory lingering from the kitchen, a hint of wood, fabric softener, maybe flowers. No, that's perfume. He recognizes it. It's the designer scent he once bought Cam for their anniversary. She loves it, but wears it only when she gets dressed up. So she's out someplace, wearing perfume. He tries to ignore a stab of jealousy, tries not to wonder or care who she might be with. Her life is her business these days. Yeah, right. That's why you're here. Oh, hell. Why are you here? Why did he blow out of the office, claiming to be going to a client lunch, only to hop the subway downtown to his car? Because I need my golf clubs. That's what he told himself. The weather this weekend is going to be gorgeous, perfect for hitting the links. Never mind that he has no one to golf with in Manhattan. The usual suspects are here in Jersey, along with his regular course. There's always Chelsea Piers, though. Okay, you're here, she's not, and you need your clubs. So get them, and go. They're in the storage room off the kitchen. He moves through the first floor, noticing that she's made few changes since he left, that he can see, anyway. She hadn't moved furniture around or taken down every picture that has him in it. There's a typical amount of household clutter. She's a pack rat. But then, so is he. Not Tess, whom he started calling Messy Tessie to tease her, because she couldn't be more opposite. Organized, a little uptight, not a procrastinator. When she was little, he and Cam used to marvel that the two of them had managed to create such a fussy little creature, so different from the two of them. That, of course, was when he thought he and Cam were two of a kind. How could he have been so wrong? How could this have happened to us? In the kitchen, he opens the fridge, remembering what Tess told him. Sure enough, there isn't a drop of liquor in sight. Just condiments, fruits and vegetables, some kind of leftover rice, and milk. A lot of it, considering that neither Cam nor Tess is crazy about it. Feeling as though he's snooping, he hurriedly closes the door. Something drops off the front and lands at his feet. He looks down to see a shopping pad. World's best mom. Shaking his head at his daughter's lack of originality, he bends to retrieve it. The gummy strip holding the top page to the pad was severed in the fall, and it comes free in his hand as he picks it up. He hastily sticks the pad back on the refrigerator, then glances at the loose page he's holding, wondering what to do with it. Cam's familiar, hurried scrawl jumps out at him. Yesterday's date is followed by a series of phrases that mean nothing to him.
Girl, 13 to 14, freckled, redhead, short braids, sunburn, green spaghetti strap top, white sandals, hot pink toenail polish, silver necklace with black pendant, hot, sunny, melting chocolate ice cream, blue painted brick, red letters, LF, girl terrified, screaming. Mike frowns. What is this? None of it makes sense. He gives the other side a cursory glance, nothing more than a regular shopping list there, before folding it in half and impulsively putting it into his pocket. Thinking twice about that, he takes it out and sticks it on the fridge with a separate magnet. Then he reconsiders. Isn't she going to wonder how it got there? You shouldn't be here. Yes, technically, he owns the house and holds claim to just about everything in it, with the notable absence of world's best mom herself. He doesn't belong in this house anymore, though, prying into Cam's new life. He grabs the shopping list and shoves it into his wallet behind Tess's latest school picture. Nice move. Get rid of the evidence and steal her stuff while you're at it. It's only a piece of paper. She'll never miss it. Maybe she will. Whatever, grab your clubs and get moving. His mental tug of war leads him toward the closet. Beside the door leading into the garage, a heap of packed luggage waits for the trip to the shore. Conspicuously absent, his own set of sturdy brown canvas and leather Filson bags. With a pang, he remembers snippets of last year's summer vacation. Much of it is a blur. Sitting in an hours-long traffic jam on the southbound parkway, finding a bat in the house, arguing with Cam. A lot. Nothing major, just stupid little disagreements. Enough of them so that he was torn whenever he had to travel back and forth to the city to work for a few days at a time. He wanted to stay at the beach house, but most of the time he was relieved to get away. Why? Because my wife felt like a stranger. Because it was easier to pretend to be the perfect family at home, going about our daily business, than at the shore where all we were supposed to be doing was having fun together. Yet they used to have fun together, long before they could afford a beach house or had the time to use it. So what happened? His demanding career. Her emotional withdrawal. Did one fuel the other? It doesn't matter now. I should go. As he reaches for the closet doorknob, he glances into the adjacent sunroom to see if it's still pouring out. Yep. Rain is still falling beyond the tall windows. The front yard might be looking bare, but at the back of the property, the tall mountain laurel shrubs are in glorious pink and white bloom, and the rest of the yard looks incredibly lush and green, much more so than ever before. Or maybe it just seems infinitely more inviting now that he's perpetually surrounded by concrete. He notices something else then, too. A carton of ice cream lying on its side on the coffee table in a pool of milky pink liquid. It's not as if that's the only thing out of place in the whole house. Mike can't help but feel uneasy, though, about the blatant or even merely neglected mess. It seems out of character to just leave it there, even for Cam. He starts toward it, thinking he'd better clean it up. Then he realizes that it's obviously been there for a while, and anyway, he can't clean it up. He's not even supposed to be here. Right. So go. This time, he does. As she steers her green Ford Taurus onto Maple Street, Lucinda Sloane takes a big bite of her Snickers bar and idly wonders whether every suburban community has a Maple Street. It sure seems that way to her. Here in the Philadelphia sprawl, Maple Streets always seem to be in the older part of town, lined with sidewalks, two-story frame houses set close to each other and to the street, and big old namesake trees. East Green Branch's Maple Street, where she's been summoned today, is no exception. Swallowing the last satisfying chocolate caramel nut mouthful, she crumples the wrapper and tosses it over her shoulder into the back seat. The downpour that followed her off the exit from Interstate 76 has let up significantly, and there are people on the street now. A nearby school must have just let out, because suddenly there are helmeted kids on bikes, teenagers with backpacks and basketballs. It's a public school, though. These kids aren't wearing uniforms like the girl was. There's not a pleated black watch plaid skirt or navy vest in sight. Braking at a stop sign, she sees a young mother pushing a stroller toward the intersection, holding the hand of a puddle-seeking toddler wearing yellow rubber boots, and followed by two older schoolchildren in rain slickers.
"Go ahead," Lucinda mouths at the mom, waving her across.
The woman clutches the toddler to keep him out of the street and says something over her shoulder to the other kids, who stop. Lucinda waves again, but the mom holds her ground on the curb, shaking her head.
"Jeez, does she think I'm going to wait until they get into the crosswalk, then run them down?"
With a shrug, Lucinda drives on. The mom, obviously skittish, overly cautious, must already have heard what happened. After all, it was only a couple of blocks from here, and news, especially tragic news, travels fast. Deciding she should double-check the address, Lucinda keeps one eye on the road while searching for it on the passenger seat. It's never been used to transport anything other than stuff she can't fit in her shoulder bag. This month, it's littered with a couple of empty Pepsi cans, fast food napkins and straws, half a bag of Fritos, and CD cases. Ah, there it is. She finds the address on the back of the envelope from the insurance bill she was opening